Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a ruling from the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, striking down the FCC's net neutrality rules in a victory for Verizon, who brought the suit, and the phone and cable giants who, given their monopoly power, will soon be able to impose their content on consumers and deny their customers the content they have been used to accessing on the previously free and open Internet. Craig Aaron, the president and CEO of Free Press, joins us to discuss the tremendous implications of this ruling and its disastrous impact on free speech, free access to information, and consumer choice. Then we will speak with West Virginia resident Russell McIver, the editor of Corporate Crime Reporter, about the corporate-friendly politics of West Virginia and the embrace of the mantra of deregulation that has led to lax and non-existent oversight of coal and chemical companies who have bought almost all of the politicians and most of the press in the state. With growing public outrage over the chemical spill that has kept 300,000 residents without water for days, we will discuss efforts to organize third-party candidates to run against corporate-friendly Democrat and corporate-owned Republican incumbents. Then finally, we will look into the verdict in the case of the acquittal of two Fullerton police officers for the beating death of an unarmed, mentally ill homeless man who repeatedly begged for his life as he was tasered, bludgeoned, and kicked to death. Adolfo Flores, an Orange County reporter with the Los Angeles Times, who has been covering the trial of the officers who killed Kelly Thomas, joins us to discuss the verdict and a possible backlash as happened with a similar verdict after the beating of Rodney King. And joining us now is Craig Aaron, the president and CEO of Free Press. He is the editor and co-author of Changing Media, Public Interest Policies for the Digital Age. And before joining Free Press, he was an investigative reporter for Public Citizen's Congress Watch. Welcome to Background Briefing, Craig Aaron.
Oh, thanks for having me back.
And today, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit ruled against the FCC and in favor of Verizon, saying that the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, does not have the power to mandate so-called net neutrality rules. And I have tried to cover this issue for years now, Craig, given the inadequate nature of the term net neutrality. It barely begins to describe the full significance of this issue. So starting with that in mind, what's your reaction to this ruling?
Well, obviously, I'm very disappointed in the ruling. I think it's a very dangerous ruling that really puts the free and open Internet as we've had it in jeopardy. And I think the fault for this decision, though, really does rest with the Federal Communications Commission, which has pursued this court case on very weak ground and didn't take a number of steps they could have to have gone in with a much stronger case against Verizon. And their inability and really their lack of political will to tackle these serious problems has really put the entire Internet in jeopardy. So, you know, net neutrality, the basic idea of net neutrality, the principle of net neutrality is just that when you go online, you should be able to go wherever you want, do whatever you want, download whatever you want, and it should not be up to your phone or cable company or internet service provider to decide which websites are going to work and which aren't. But because of the FCC's missteps, today the court has opened the door to allowing a Verizon or an AT&T or a Comcast to block websites they don't like, to discriminate and speed up or slow down content they like or don't like, and to really begin transforming that free and open Internet that we all rely on into something that looks a lot more like cable television, where a few big companies can pick and choose what channels you get and what kind of news and information are going to get a priority.
So how much is this to do with the fact that the new FCC chairman, Tom Wheeler, was a former lobbyist for the big telecom giants?
Well, it's not Tom Wheeler's fault yet. Really, the problem here is with Mr. Wheeler's predecessor, Julius Genachowski, who the last time this very same court questioned the FCC's authority, he faced a choice. And that choice was whether to go back and reverse a series of really disastrous decisions made during the Bush administration, or to go back into court essentially making the same arguments that lost in the previous case. And unfortunately, he chose the latter path. So instead of reclassifying, is what it's called, instead of reclassifying broadband under the law and treating our broadband networks as they had always been treated from the beginning, he tried this much more narrow path, and it didn't work. Now, Mr. Wheeler is the one whose desk this is going to land on next, and he'll have to decide whether the FCC appeals this decision to the Supreme Court and whether he has the political will to take on the powerful phone companies and reverse the bad decisions of his Republican and Democratic predecessors and actually protect Internet users. Some of the things he said so far indicate that he might be willing to take on that fight. Other things suggest that he may not. So this is where the next big fight is going to be, right back at the Federal Communications Commission. And the question will be whether Mr. Wheeler will stand up for Internet users, or whether, again, the FCC will just be doing favors and really fulfilling the wish list of the most powerful phone and cable companies.
And Craig Aaron, it was the Bush administration's appointee to the chairmanship of the FCC, Michael Powell, the son of Colin Powell, who gave away the store and flew around in Warner Brothers jet and couldn't wait to be a hireling and a toady to corporate power. But you're saying that the giveaway of Michael Powell's, rather than challenge that, Jenikowski took the wrong route. And now,
exactly.
And that's where we are at today.
Yeah, that created the mess we have now. So the original sin does rest with Michael Powell, the same Michael Powell who is now the cable industry's top lobbyist and celebrating today's decision. But he's the one who originally said that these long-standing protections shouldn't apply to broadband networks, and created a case that went all the way to the Supreme Court and created this mess that we face now. But the Obama administration had the opportunity several years ago, back in 2009 and 2010, to reverse the bad decisions of the Bush administration, but they didn't do it because it was considered too politically difficult. And unfortunately, that meant they went back to court with a very weak hand, and the judges really didn't buy the FCC's arguments at all. And now it's important to note, though, that in their decision today, they didn't say that net neutrality was a bad policy or that we shouldn't protect our broadband networks. What they said is the way the FCC was applying its rules and the legal basis for those rules was unfounded. So the judges actually paint a very clear path for what the FCC should do if they indeed do want to protect our internet and broadband networks. The question is whether the FCC, which was about to face an onslaught of lobbying from the phone and cable companies, once again will have the will to actually do it. It's why it's so important that people out there speak, you know, get informed and speak up about this issue.
Again, I'm speaking with Craig Aaron, who's the president and CEO of Free Press and is the editor and co-author of Changing Media, Public Interest Policies for the Digital Age. Before joining Free Press, he was an investigative reporter for Public Citizen's Congress Watch. But in the context of broadband, you have to recognize, or one has to recognize, surely, Craig, that the USA that invented the Internet, and wasn't Al Gore necessarily, but it was invented here in the United States, they are slipping further and further behind the rest of the world in both broadband diffusion and speed. And there are a couple of anomalies, like the city of Chattanooga has made broadband a utility with very, very high speed. And, you know, the French have what, at least 10 times the speed that we have and pay, I think, a quarter of the price that we pay. And when you say that we're heading in the direction of as bad as our cable television is, it's all going to be bundled at any rate by the same people that control the pipe into your home, and you'll get the same lousy service where they'll pick and choose the poverty of choice, as it's known. But what you want to see and what you want to get will be put in the slow lane.
Well, that's absolutely the danger, and today's decision certainly worsens our standing in the world. There's no question about it, because the way that countries like Japan and South Korea and France have built a faster internet that in some cases is twice as fast or far faster than what you get here for half the price, maybe 50 times as fast for half the price, is by actually pursuing the kind of policies we used to have, so-called open access or common carrier policies. And those are the exact policies that come under attack in today's decision. So if the FCC doesn't respond to this decision, the opportunity for competition, the protection against discrimination will go away, and we'll never catch up with the rest of the world. It also, I think, does speak to the importance of municipal alternatives and other networks like they've built in places like Chattanooga, Tennessee, Burlington, Vermont, and elsewhere where, you know, where if the community or the municipality actually controls the network, there may be other ways, other options at least, for people to vote with their feet and different kind of protections that can be imposed. But, of course, these same companies are also fighting everywhere they can, and they've been successful in 18 or 19 states so far in actually preventing these networks from coming online in a lot of places. So the amount of power wielded by the phone and cable lobby is immense. I mean, they spend more money in Washington than any other industry this side of the prescription drug industry, more money than the oil and gas industry spends. So they are a very powerful lobbying force. And so it is an uphill climb, but it's just that important because these are the networks of the future. And the beauty of the free and open Internet is if you have a good idea, if you have an economic innovation, if you have something to say that no one else is saying, you have just as much chance as anybody else to find that audience. But if this decision is allowed to stand, the next Google being developed out in a garage somewhere will never get off the ground. Independent content, independent news and information will never enjoy the same kind of speeds and services the mainstream news outlets and the companies that are controlled by Comcast, NBC, and Verizon, and AT&T, and Time Warner. So there is a lot at stake in this decision, and frankly, a lot at stake in the FCC's ability to do all sorts of things, including expanding broadband, public safety, even privacy. The Communications Act contains a whole sort of privacy protections. A lot of those have been ignored. But if you care about what these companies are doing, what they're handing over to the NSA, you need to care about this court decision today as well.
And this court decision you're referring to is the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, held today that the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, does not have the power to mandate so-called net neutrality in a suit brought by Verizon, who are clearly the winner. Now, and Verizon, of course, have sued throughout this country to stop municipalities from having an alternative to their pipe into the homes. And they have successfully done that both at the state level and at the municipal level. Here in California, in Santa Monica, the city of Santa Monica is now putting in high-speed broadband. And guess what? It's attracting all kinds of business because everybody, and let's face it, a lot of people use the Internet nowadays. Every company in the world wants to have this incredibly fast high-speed Internet that, you, as you mentioned, the Japanese have, the South Koreans have it everywhere. It's a right, it's a utility in every home, in every hospital. I mean, the potential, the economic upside of high-speed broadband is extraordinary. And yet these big companies, these American corporations who say that they're capitalists and who say they're for the free enterprise system, are basically writing rules to monopolize their lousy service. That's what it comes down to.
I think that's absolutely correct. They are absolutely attempting to profit from and maintain scarcity because that's the easiest way for them to make money. Unfortunately, that's doing serious damage to our country, to our international competitiveness, to opportunities that face, you know, that entrepreneurs have. I mean, you know, if a kid in South Korea can get to the Library of Congress website faster than a kid a few miles from here and where I am in Washington, D.C., we have a real problem, and that is a problem that is being reinforced by the powerful phone and cable companies who are only interested in their short-term gains. That's why we need a watchdog on the beat. It's why we need a counterweight coming from the Federal Communications Commission. And this is going to be the biggest test yet for that body of whether it is going to exist, whether it's going to be relevant. I mean, the idea that the Federal Communications Commission has no authority over the most important communications network existing is preposterous, and yet that's what we're staring at in the wake of this decision. And it's all the more reason we need them to act and act immediately.
Well, I happen to be a Time Warner Cable customer, and I got hosed like every other consumer did when they had their little spat with CBS, you know, a bunch of corporate lawyers playing fraternity chicken with each other, you know, and they could give a damn about the consumer. This was their own little stit, and we all, you know, were blacked out, and too bad, you know. So that gives you an idea of their attitude, how little they care about their customers.
And it's because they face no competition. You really don't have a choice. Maybe at best you have one other choice, but the cost of switching to you as an individual, especially once you have your cell phone and your home phone and everything else, your internet service, your cable TV, all tied in with one company, is so high that there's no incentive. And yet they're spending all of their energy not making your service faster, not improving your customer service, not taking those 80 and 90% profit margins that they make off your internet service, your modem. They're not putting that back into the product. What they're doing is putting it into lobbying to try to maintain that scarcity and cut off that competition. And these are the companies that have divided up the country so that you only have one choice for cable television. Maybe if you're lucky, the phone company has come in. You have just a handful of choices for your wireless internet. And this is how broken the system has become. But, of course, the pipes that they control are only becoming more important to our lives every day, and I think that's why there's so much at stake here.
And, of course, the former CEO of Verizon apparently was something of a visionary who came up with this Fios, laying all this fiber optic cable. But Wall Street decided that he was thinking too long-term, and they decided to cut him off at the knees and put some flunky in. And, of course, as it ironically, the most profitable part of Verizon's portfolio is its Fios. So, you know, you're dealing with these corrupt dinosaurs like Comcast, NBC, Comcast, Verizon, and Time Warner Cable. And my understanding, Craig, and fill me in on this, if you will, my understanding is it's possible that short of the FCC finding some cojones and doing the public's business instead of rolling over for the big telecom and cable lobbies, short of that, isn't Google putting in fiber optics in a few cities now? And that could do a whole end run around these crooked monopolies that are just gouging us with crappy service?
It certainly has its possibility, and there are a few places, Kansas City, Utah, Austin, Texas is about to come online where Google is getting into the broadband business. And any competition is good competition. So if they're offering, you know, another alternative, that's competitive pressure on the incumbents, and it's a good thing. You know, unfortunately, though, Google in its own way is following some of the bad habits of the incumbents with very restrictions on how you can use the service. And they happen to only be deploying it in places that have deregulated completely. So Google's offering, in some cases, a very good product, but they don't want any of the public service obligations that come with it. And so there's a real risk of a race to the bottom. You know, as a consumer, you benefit from as many choices as possible. And unfortunately, Wall Street believes the exact opposite. And you're seeing it in the cell phone market now, where there actually is some competition because the government did step in and stop some mergers from happening. And yet when Wall Street talks about it, they talk about, you know, lost revenue because consumers actually have choices. That shows you how upside down the calculus is. I think we do want to encourage investors like Google, but we also want to encourage communities building their own systems. You know, really all of the above. The more choices we have as consumers, the better chance we're going to have. And really, it's the most powerful way to rein in this kind of misbehavior and blocking. If I have the option to vote with my feet, if I can go get another provider, then it's a lot harder for Comcast or Verizon or AT&T to start interfering with my content. But if I don't have that choice, and most of the country has at most two choices, and in many places only one choice for truly high-speed internet access, then there's no hope, and then they can do whatever they want, and that's the kind of system that they're trying to entrench.
So it's time for all those netheads to get up off the couch and march on Washington, right?
Well, I think that's absolutely right. And we've seen it happen before. I mean, net neutrality is only a national issue because millions of people got involved. We've stopped web censorship bills like the SOPA-PIPA bills. We've seen the incredible public outpouring of against NSA spying and surveillance. And this net neutrality issue needs to be right there. But it is going to take that kind of massive public mobilization, pressure on Congress, pressure on the new leadership of the FCC, if we're going to reverse what happened here today and actually protect Internet users. If we don't do that, if we don't speak out, then we're going to lose, you know, the most remarkable arena for free speech, democratic participation, and economic innovation that we've ever seen.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Craig Aaron.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Craig Aaron, who is the president and CEO of Free Press and is the editor and co-author of Changing Media Public Interest Policies for the Digital Age. Before joining Free Press, he was an investigative reporter for Public Citizen's Congress Watch. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back talking with West Virginia resident Russell McIver, the editor of Corporate Crime Reporter. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Russell McIver, who is the editor of Corporate Crime Reporter. His books include Corporate Crime and Violence, Big Business Power and the Abuse of the Public Trust, Corporate Predators, The Hunt for Mega Profits and the Attack on Democracy, and On the Rampage, Corporate Predators and the Destruction of Democracy. He's also the founder of the Single Payer Action and is currently working with the West Virginia local activist organization, MorganCountyUSA.org. Welcome to Background Briefing, Russell McIver.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And the state of West Virginia, where you reside, is obviously very much in the news. It is extraordinary. I did speak to a reporter a couple of days ago from the Charleston Gazette just to get a sort of the human interest side of this story. I mean, it just shows you how much we are dependent upon clean drinking water, and the idea that 300,000 people have been without water for 4 days plus now is an extraordinary story in itself. So give me your sense as being there in the state. Are the people as outraged as I imagine, as certainly as I would be?
Well, there's real suffering. The people who can afford to are leaving the area of Charleston, going to Morgantown upstate or coming further east so that they can shower and, you know, drink water and eat. But the vast majority of the 300,000 can't afford to do that. And so they're there, and they've been 4 or 5 days without showers, and they drink only the water that's bottled and brought in. And they're getting angry. I've been listening to talk radio here. One state worker was very upset that she was told that she had to come into work, and that there would be, you know, no leave policy. And at the same time, the state legislature, which just came in last week, was told that they could go home. So there is this double standard that cuts through the state. What most people are now starting to realize is that they've been sold a bill of goods about deregulation. The business community, both political parties, have made regulation a dirty word. And regulation means law and order. But we've seen last week the fruits of the deregulatory dogma that's spouted by almost universally by politicians of both parties when it comes to the coal and chemical industry in West Virginia. So I think, you know, people are starting to see through it a little bit now, and they're getting angry. And you're hearing that on the talk shows, the right-wing talk shows, people ripping these guys for, you know, spouting deregulation at every turn. And, of course, the political establishment, the corporate establishment, is now starting to backpedal in the face of the people's anger. So there is a political opening now in the state. And so, for example, in the 2nd Congressional District, the Congresswoman is Capito. She's running for the U.S. Senate to take Jay Rockefeller's seat. Rockefeller just retired. And so there's an opening here. The presumed Democratic nominee is a guy named Nick Casey, who was the who's the treasurer for Senator Joe Manchin. And Casey has been a lobbyist for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. That's the Democrat. The Republican, yet to be found, is a field of about 10, is going to be a pretty hard right conservative. And so there's an opening there, and former CBS News guy Ed Rabel has decided to run. He's from Charleston. He lives in the Charleston area now, and he's decided to run as an independent and lead a slate of independents. So here in the Eastern Panhandle, we're going to be running a slate of independents for the House of Delegates, which is the lower house in the West Virginia legislature. So there's an opening here to make a difference, to push back against the corporate domination of the political system, of the media, of the universities, of the, you know, almost every major institution in the state has been, the corporations and the coal companies and the chemical companies have a stranglehold. And so, but now there's we're trying to create a little bit of breathing room so we can try and make a difference.
Again, I'm speaking with Russell McIver, who is the editor of Corporate Crime Reporter. His books include Corporate Crime and Violence, Big Business Power and the Abuse of the Public Trust, Corporate Predators, The Hunt for Mega Profits and the Attack on Democracy, and On the Rampage, Corporate Predators and the Destruction of Democracy. He's also the founder of Single Payer Action and is currently working with the West Virginia local activist organization, MorganCountyUSA.org. So, my understanding, though, in terms of the political class have been bought, both parties. By the way, the idea that the Democrat worked for the Chamber of Commerce is pretty extraordinary, to think that it is the Chamber of Commerce that brought the suit was argued yesterday in the Supreme Court, you know, in favor of taking away the president's recess appointment authority. And there you have, you know, you think that the Democrats were recognizing that the Chamber of Commerce have put this suit up against the president, that they'd want to support the president as opposed to support the Chamber of Commerce. But I guess that's a story for another day. What about law and order? You've got the U.S. attorney here. He has not shown himself to be a fighter for justice. He basically gave Massey Energy a free pass, did he not, after that extraordinary, I think, what the worst...
There was an explosion at the Upper Branch mine in April 2010.
Right.
Killed 29 miners.
The worst industrial accident in 40 years in the United States. So,
And the interesting, you know, Booth Goodwin's an interesting guy. You know, he did criminally prosecute a couple of the executives, Massey executives. His office, you know, apparently there's still an open investigation into the higher-ranking executives there, Don Blankenship and so forth. But the reality is, when it came to the company itself, he blinked. You had this massive, like, 400-page report from the Department of Labor identifying 300. Violations, 9 serious violations that led to this explosion that killed the 29 workers. So he had a roadmap, and instead he enters into this non-prosecution agreement with the corporation, effectively letting them off the hook. And so this is the kind of thing he's facing now. Now, I think there is a culture of, a difference here. Because you don't have a major Wall Street firm in Freedom Industries. I think the guy you talked to, Gutman, reported that one of the founders of this company has been, has been found guilty of tax evasion or something.
And possession for sale of 10 to 12 ounces of cocaine.
Right. And so this is not the same kind. It's not like, you know, one of these elite Wall Street firms or major Fortune 500 companies like Massey. And so he'll have, and that's the sort of the calculus on corporate crime, that he'll have more of an open field to go after this company if he finds that there's been criminal activity, and to criminally prosecute both the company and the executives if he finds criminal activity. But the investigation is still young. The reality, though, is that that it's that kind of brute political power that allowed this leak to happen, because you have a West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection that knew about this facility, that knew about this storage tank, that knew about this chemical being there just a mile and a half upriver from the water facility, the drinking water facility, and, obviously did not take that threat seriously. And, I've been talking to waterworks people around the country, and what they do is they come up with these things called watershed assessment plans, where they're supposed to look upriver to the threats and then go and meet with the executives of these facilities and do a walkthrough of the plant and make sure that the threats are under control. So if you have a chemical facility or a nuclear power facility, then the executives from the water company are supposed to take proactive action and go and check out these facilities to make sure that there's not an active threat. The other thing that's happening is that I believe that this water company is privately owned. About 80% of the waterworks, drinking water utilities in the United States are publicly owned, and it used to be 100%. But there's this push for privatization of public water systems, and that, in fact, happened here. And when you talk to public water executives, one thing they'll tell you, Ian, is that when you put the profit motive into a public utility, you end up with the usual result, and that is executives cutting costs. Now, who knows what happened in this situation? Whether the executives cut costs here and didn't do the proper watershed assessment is an open question.
Well, Russell McIver, in terms of placing our faith in the U.S. attorney there, Booth Goodwin, presumably he's heard of the Clean Water Act. The fact that he gave Massey Energy a free pass, and after all, they were the ones that trucked out all of the coal miners as a backdrop for Mitt Romney. The Labor Department had issued a 972-page report on the mine disaster at the Upper Big Branch mine that killed all of those miners, which was the Labor Department's study, concluded that Massey's unlawful policies and practices were the root cause of this tragedy, and yet...
Well, absolutely, but here's the difference. Here's the difference between the two. Massey is a major American company, very powerful, politically well-connected. I don't think you got that in Freedom Industries. So...
They can make an example, then,
the political economy of corporate criminal prosecution is this, that if the big law firm shows up at your office, it's less likely that the company or the executives are going to be criminally prosecuted and pay the price. If it's if it's a much smaller firm represented by less well-known lawyers, then the probabilities are, if there's criminal conduct, there will be criminal prosecution. So the lower you are in the totem pole, the more likely you're going to be criminally prosecuted. And I think that would be the case here.
Well, just turning to the 2nd District, Congressional District in West Virginia that you mentioned, where CBS News, former CBS Newsman Ed Rabel, a local resident, is running for Congress against the woman who's now running for the Senate, open Senate seat from Jay Rockefeller. And you also have, of course, Senator Manchin, and you have a governor there who's nominally a Democrat.
Nominally, yes.
So, one of the excuses that Manchin and other of these blue dog Democrats have is that they can't go too far to the left because they won't get reelected, and that's why he's taken a pro-gun.
Well, that's what we're trying to test here, because a lot of people on the left say, forget about electoral politics. That it's, you're never going to get anywhere. You're never going to create the change you need through electoral politics. You're not going to win. You're going to get a small percentage of the vote. But we're trying to put that to the test here, because, there's 100 members of the House of Delegates, and 10 of them are here in the Eastern Panhandle, and we're trying to recruit like 6 or 7 candidates to run. there's a couple things in our favor. One is you can win these races with 3,000 votes. There's about, you know, for each one of these districts, it's about 25,000 to 30,000 voters. And so you need only 3,000. And even if they're right-wing districts, which they tend to be very hard right districts. That's the thing about West Virginia, and that's why Manchin is a blue dog. But the reality is the Democrats give up on these districts. So that's why, you know, increasingly progressive, you know, lefty Democrats are giving up on the Democratic Party and saying, let's just run as independents. And because there's too much baggage being a Democrat because of all the chicanery and compromises and corruption, that they say, why should we carry that baggage? You know, we knock on the door, we say we're Democrat, we get it slammed in our face. So you go around and you get the voter list and you pound the pavement and you meet people and you talk to them face to face, and you put it to them about, you know, the nature of deregulation, why regulation was what regulation actually means, law and order. And now we have front and center this chemical spill that destroyed the drinking water for 300,000 people for a period of 5 days at least. And so we're finding that that's resonating. Whether we can pull this off is an open question, because people are depressed, they're isolated, they're on their couch. Even the plugged in ones are plugged in and not meeting people and not going out and interacting. So it's an uphill battle. But we find that there's an opening. And the other thing is there's I don't know if you've ever interviewed Richard Winger of Ballot Access News, Ian. Mm-hmm. And Richard has been documenting, you know, how it's very difficult to get on the ballot in most states. But in West Virginia, thanks to Richard's work and the work of some ballot access activists here, we only need 1% of the previous year's vote total to get on the ballot. So in these House of Delegates races, it's fewer than 100 signatures. And we don't need the signatures until August 1. So it used to be much earlier in the year, like April or May, and it used to be 2%, which is a higher figure. And for Ed Rabel, you know, he just needs a couple thousand signatures and he gets on. So because of Richard's work, it's easier ballot access for independents. Richard told me that there hasn't been a non-Republican, non-Democrat elected to the West Virginia legislature since 1906, when a prohibition candidate was elected. And there hasn't been ever a non-Republican or Democrat elected to Congress from West Virginia. So we're hoping also to make history.
Well, but I understand, and just we've got to wrap it up here, Russell, but my understanding is that, you know, first of all, there's just a Gallup poll that said 23% of Americans now declare themselves liberals, 38% conservative. The liberals are making slow gains, at least those who identify themselves as such. It's often just a question of what the kind of questions you ask of people. People actually may be a lot more left-wing than they realize, even though some of them think that they're actually conservative. You just were saying that on right-wing talk radio in West Virginia now, people are really angry. That's one of the things that I find about our politics, that, you know, that people don't even, you know, the left doesn't, or the Democrats don't recognize how much potential there is out there in the terms of people's anxieties and understandings. It's just they don't frame and they don't approach things properly.
Well, we're going to be testing new ideas, new slogans, new ways of talking to people. One thing, I read an article about a mayoral candidate down in Columbia, and they went around and they had these town hall meetings. And actually, through the town hall meetings, developed their platform. So it wasn't a top-down thing. It was a lateral kind of campaign where these town hall meetings, you know, and that's the great thing about Ed. He's a great listener. And I've had him out here to the Eastern Panhandle where 30, 40 people, and it's not one way. It's, okay, I want to hear what you have to say. What are your concerns? What would you like this campaign to be? And just was like listening and taking notes. And so, you know, I think that's – and the guy down in Columbia actually won the election based on that strategy. So that's right. I think we have to do more listening and less talking and push forth a people's agenda.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Russell McIver.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Russell McIver, who's the editor of The Corporate Crime Reporter. His books include Corporate Crime and Violence, Big Business Power and the Abuse of the Public Trust, Corporate Predators, The Hunt for Mega Profits and the Attack on Democracy, and On the Rampage, Corporate Predators and the Destruction of Democracy. He's also the founder of the Single Payer Action and is currently working with the West Virginia local activist organization, MorganCountyUSA.org. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with the LA Times reporter, Adolfo Flores, who covered the trial of the police officers who killed Kelly Thomas. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Adolfo Flores, who is an Orange County reporter for the Los Angeles Times, who has been covering the trial against the Fullerton police officers accused of killing Kelly Thomas. Welcome to Background Briefing, Adolfo Flores.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for having me.
And since we have a national audience, let's sort of begin with the basics, Adolfo. 2.5 years ago, at the train station in Fullerton, Orange County, the more conservative part of Los Angeles, if you will, or the Southern California, was beaten to death by police officers, and it was captured on a surveillance camera. Those are the broad strokes.
Yes.
So tell me then, how did we get to this point today, in the sense that 2.5 years later, we have a verdict that many feel is somewhat reminiscent of the Rodney King verdict, but apparently, as of now, we don't have the same outrage, which, of course, resulted in a big chunk of Los Angeles being set on fire and looting and mayhem, etc. So what's your sense, then, of the relative calm?
To be honest, I don't know why it is that it didn't elicit that type of response. Because there have been protests in Fullerton. There were some last night and this morning. But they were pretty calm for the most part. And, yeah, I mean, to be honest, I don't know what they're thinking. I think right now a lot of people that are upset are hoping that the FBI will look into it and file charges. But we have no sense for when that might be.
So tell me what it was like in the courthouse when the verdict was read.
It was really emotional. I mean, people tried to at least contain their emotions while they were in the courthouse, but it was hard for them, especially for Ron Thomas. And, he put his head against the back of the seat, and it looks like he was crying, and so was Kathy Thomas, Kelly's mom. She definitely was crying, and they're very upset. And people there were, the courtroom was packed with supporters. So, yeah, it was pretty evident by what they said and the way they acted that they didn't like the verdict.
And Ron Thomas is Kelly Thomas's father, right?
Oh, yes. Ron Thomas is Kelly Thomas's father. He's been the one pushing for the charges and, leading the charge.
But my understanding is that Ron Thomas is himself a former Fullerton police officer.
Not Fullerton. He was a deputy with the sheriff's department. He worked in the jails briefly. I don't know for how long, but he was a former deputy.
So he's a former law enforcement officer then?
Yes.
And apparently he burst into tears and kicked and stomped his foot and said, "Where do we really find justice anymore in our justice system? It has been proven right here today that they will get away with it. They will get away with it." Obviously, a deeply bitter experience for the father of this unfortunate homeless, schizophrenic, unarmed young man. So what kind of a picture of the victim was portrayed in this? Because I imagine the main defense, of course, was of the police officers themselves. But who made a case for the victim?
You know, Rakakis, the district attorney, you know, he depicted Thomas as a he admitted that he had mental issues, but that he was an aggressor that night. He was just trying to go about his day. The defense, on the other hand, you know, they had previous police encounters with Thomas, or an incident at his home. You know, at one point he hit his grandfather with a fireplace poker. You know, he choked his mom, and you know, just in the streets, he had a couple of run-ins. He punched someone in the face. So they were very polar, very different views of Thomas presented to the jurors.
So this was in, I guess, in the category of blame the victim, but they were trying to portray him as a violent person because there's no evidence of any violence from him, is there, Kelly Thomas, on the surveillance tape?
No, I mean, the surveillance tape, I mean, it's depending on who you ask. You know, the defense said that, you know, he was fighting back and he was violent, and they described the fight with cops as, you know, the fight of their lives. The prosecutor said that wasn't the case. You know, he was not the aggressor, and that he only fought back because, you know, he thought his life was in danger, and he had the, you know, he had the right to defend himself, the right to self-defense. So that was the issue with the video, is that everyone had their own views on it, and we don't know what the jury thought of it. I mean, I wasn't able to grab any of the jurors, and I haven't seen any other reports, so I don't know how they took it. But each side was really, really good about getting their point across.
But doesn't the video show at one point, or perhaps even at several points, at least one of the police officers who were put on trial for the beating death of Kelly Thomas turning his back on him at one point? I mean, it seemed, from my viewing of the tape, it seems that the police were quite casual. They were taking their time about beating this guy to death.
In the beginning, the encounter between former officer Manuel Ramos and Kelly Thomas wasn't really, I mean, you wouldn't think that it would get to the point that it did. You know, he did turn his back and he walked away, came back. I think what was the turning point, and that the prosecution argued was the turning point, was when he told Thomas, and he put on the gloves and he said he was going to punch him. And a few seconds later, you know, Thomas is on the ground, you know, fighting with the two cops.
Well, my understanding that what Officer Ramos said to Thomas when he put the gloves on, the surgical gloves, "Now, see my fists, they are getting ready to F you up."
Yes, yeah, that's exactly what he said.
And that did not, as far as the jurors are concerned, that wasn't intent, that wasn't premeditation?
I don't know. You know, like I said, the prosecution said that Ramos crossed the line by saying that he shouldn't have said that. I can't speak to what the jurors, how they took it, but yeah, everyone really focused in on that point.
Well, of course, the victim here is a homeless guy living on the streets, and he, you know, is obviously mentally ill. He's been diagnosed with schizophrenia. So, you know, it seemed like he was confused, which is not surprising, right? I mean, he was saying things like when they were barking at him, the police, he said, "I'm trying, I'm sorry." Isn't that pretty clear on the tape?
Yeah, you know, and he was very, I mean, like, from the beginning, even before the incident turned violent, he had a hard time when the officer told him to put his hands on his knees and stick his feet out. You know, you could definitely tell he had a hard time understanding. And then once he was on the ground, from the officers, you know, he kept saying, "I can't breathe, help me, I'm sorry." You know, so yeah, those are things that he said.
Well, he also cried out to his father, did he not? Cried out at least, apparently, 30 times, crying out.
Oh, yeah, he did. He, you know, cried out for his father to help him. And he also, at some point, you know, he called out for God to help him.
And I guess in this case, God forsake him, you know. So Again, I'm speaking with Adolfo Flores, an Orange County reporter for the Los Angeles Times, who's been covering the trial against the Fullerton police officers accused of killing Kelly Thomas. Were there any, in terms of the prosecution in this case, those that are trying to bring justice for Kelly Thomas and his parents, was the issue of mental health and the fact that we have so many homeless and mentally ill people on the streets, and many people attribute that to the decision made many years ago by then-Governor Ronald Reagan to change the rules about commitment of mentally ill people and essentially empty the mental hospitals. Was there any sort of discussion of how we deal with mentally ill people and why so many of them end up homeless?
That was not a point that came up in the trial, you know, but I think, as we all know, the case itself did raise a lot of issues about mental health care in California. And the family has spoken about how hard it was to get him help. And so, yeah, it was not a major point in the trial, but it was outside of the courtroom.
And I take it outside of the courtroom, after the verdict was read, people sort of started to gather at this sort of makeshift shrine at the spot where he was beaten to death, right next to, I believe, the Fullerton railway station, right?
Oh, yeah. They met at the Fullerton bus depot, and there was a shrine there. They had a guest book for people to sign to give to Thomas's family. And then later on in the night, they walked the streets of downtown Fullerton and made their way to the police station, where they were out there for about, outside the police station, I'd say 20, 30 minutes before they went back to the bus depot and continued to protest the verdict.
And what were some of the signs and the manifestations of these protests, particularly the ones in front of the police station, which I believe was closed at the time?
Yeah, it was closed. So nobody came out. There wasn't police presence really either at the protest. A police cruiser drove by at some point, but some of the signs, you know, they said stuff, you know, honk for justice, that Kelly Thomas's name on them. The other, you know, our children shouldn't have to fear cops, and, you know, we're not against police, we're against police brutality. Those are just some of the signs people were holding up.
So, Adolfo, did you get any feedback from any of the police that were driving by, that were, you know, being exposed to this, the demonstrations and the signs that you just described?
The cops didn't say anything. They were at a red light. They just looked out and then they kept driving. So they didn't respond. But the protesters were definitely upset, you know, at them. And, you know, they kind of threatened them. They said, you know, we're coming for you, and now you need to be afraid of us. So that was a little bit tense, but it was very, very short.
Well, my understanding is that this has led the police to put these two defendants who were just acquitted, the two police officers, a third one, the charges were dropped against him, put them into some kind of protective custody. Is that your understanding?
So my understanding from the Fulton Police Department was that they wouldn't really go into what they're doing, but they said that they were monitoring social media messages and, you know, everything outside, and they had taken appropriate measures. But again, they wouldn't elaborate on what they were.
So did the DA ever bring up the context of the thin blue line, the notion that the police close ranks, they tend to, whenever a fellow officer is on trial? I mean, did any, for example, any of his fellow police officers ever testify against him?
No, none of them did. They had a couple of them who testified on their behalf, you know, that them, in regards to the training they received and the policy and what they said that night. But yeah, none of them testified against them.
So then, what's your guess, Adolfo Flores, about why it is that this jury found them not guilty, acquitted them, and then obviously creating this kind of outrage, which I think is fairly widely felt? It hasn't manifested itself in the way that the outrage of the Rodney King verdict did, of course, but, you know, time will tell, I suppose. But in trying to understand, for those people in our audience who don't understand how an unarmed, mentally ill homeless man could be beaten to death in such a savage way that was captured on video, and yet those who perpetrated it are able to walk free. Where do you think the prosecution dropped the ball?
Well, I mean, I don't know where they dropped the ball, but I think the jurors give police a lot of leeway because of the job that they have. It's a dangerous job, and if the prosecutors weren't able to prove, I think it was difficult for the prosecutors to prove that the officers used more force than necessary because jurors tend to give officers a lot more leeway in terms of force.
Well, did they make the case that these officers were acting within the rules? In other words, they were following the rules?
Well, the defense lawyers said that they did, and they brought in their use of force trainer, who said that they acted within the training. He also said that they acted within policy. However, the prosecution, they got the personnel records of the two officers, and then they weren't introduced into evidence, but the jurors were told to ignore the testimony from the trainer, who said that the two officers acted within policy. However, the defense continued to say that, despite that, the two officers relied on their training correctly.
Well, apparently, though, Thomas was not unknown to the police, right? I mean, he was a sort of fixture, a homeless guy that was around all the time.
And in fact, Ramos had a number of previous encounters with him, and he knew him.
So why did anybody ask Ramos, or I guess he didn't necessarily testify, but did anybody ask why this time? If you know this guy, he's a harmless, homeless guy who's a schizophrenic. Why this time? Why was he suddenly a threat?
They didn't ask Ramos that. But it was the prosecutors that bring up that point, is that he knew who he was. He knew he had mental issues. But in terms of what Ramos was thinking, why that time was different, I don't know. It wasn't something that came up.
So just in closing then, Adolfo Flores, is there any indication, that we've mentioned the Rodney King situation a number of times? It's obviously, an easy kind of mental association to make. But I don't know, whether there's a constituency for, homeless, schizophrenic young white man out there that's willing to take to the streets.
They have a couple of protests planned for this weekend, I think later today in Los Angeles. But I'm not getting a sense that it'll be of the magnitude of the Rodney King riots. But they are organizing, but I don't know what they're going to look like. So far, they haven't been that large.
Well, Adolfo Flores, I thank you so much for joining us.
No, thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Adolfo Flores, who's an Orange County reporter for the Los Angeles Times, who has been covering the trial against the Fullerton police officers accused of killing Kelly Thomas. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.